Thanks for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. Joe DiMaggio called Satchel Paige the best and fastest pitcher he ever faced. Satchel knew from an early age that he would one day become one of the greatest pitchers the sport has ever known. His legacy is certain, but along with the other stars of baseball's Negro Leagues, he may never be fully appreciated. Larry Tye has written a new biography of Satchel Paige. It's called Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. Larry Tye joins me in the studio. Welcome, Larry.
Great to be with you.
We can agree on Satchel Paige. We'll have to disagree with the fact that you're a Red Sox fan, I'm a Yankees fan, but what the heck, right?
Exactly. As long as we're still a game ahead, we can disagree on that.
Please call us, 1-800-433-8850 to talk to Larry Tye, or send us an email, drshow@wamu.org. Larry, just answer a basic question. Why is it worth a whole biography of Satchel Paige? What's its significance?
Two reasons. The first has to do with what he was like as a ball player. And what he was like is that he threw the ball so hard and so fast that his catchers had to cushion their gloves with beefsteaks because their hands would burn otherwise. He threw the ball so accurately that his teammates would stand there with lit cigarettes in their mouth, letting him throw a hard ball at them at 90 miles an hour to knock them out. And that is what you call faith. So that's the baseball side of
Satchel. Knock out the cigarette.
Knock out the cigarette. Definitely not the teammates. Generally survived it and the cigarettes didn't. That's the baseball half of who Satchel was. But the real reason that I wrote this book was because I think Satchel's life also is the perfect mirror of that horrible era called Jim Crow. He was born just when Jim Crow was coming to his hometown of Mobile, Alabama. It had been a tolerant city that was filled with lynchings the year of his birth. And his whole career, the prime years of which were spent in the Negro Leagues, are the perfect reflection of what Jim Crow America was all about in that era of racial segregation.
Now, just so people are not offended by our use of the word Negro, this is what those leagues were called. And you point out that in interviewing many veterans of those leagues, you try to use the terminology they use themselves to describe the leagues and themselves.
Absolutely. Which went from colored to Negro to black to African American. And the book reflects those uses during those periods.
And Larry, of course, one of the most noteworthy things about Satchel Paige is that nickname. Very few people know his real name was Leroy. There are many legends which you recount, and as with anything with Satchel Paige, there are many versions because he was a very mysterious figure and manipulated the truth himself. But what was your best read about where that nickname came from?
I loved his official version, which was, I think probably had some truth to it. It was that when he was 8 or 9 years old, growing up with 11 brothers and sisters and a mother who was a washerwoman, a father who called himself a landscaper and was actually an occasionally employed gardener, Satchel had to go out at 8 or 9 to the local LNN train station and lug bags for a dime a bag. One day he decided that if he put together a system of ropes and pulleys and pulled 3 to 4 bags at once, he could earn 3 to 4 dimes. A buddy saw him, dubbed him a walking satchel tree, and he says that's when the name stuck. Another buddy named Wilbur Hines had a better version, which was that it wasn't that Satchel was lugging bags, it is that he was stealing them, and that he, Wilbur Hines, said, "You are Satchel forever."
Larry, as you point out, Satchel Paige was born in the Jim Crow South and was very much a product of the Jim Crow South. And how did that mark him? How did that shape him? What did that mean to his life and his outlook?
It meant that he grew up poor. It meant that he grew up with restrictions on everything from the parks that he could go to the schools that he could attend, to the public bathrooms that he could use. And it meant that at age 12, he was nabbed for stealing trinkets from a five and dime store, and he was sent to an institution whose very name suggests what that era was like. It was called the Alabama Reform School for Juvenile Negro Lawbreakers, which was clearly racially segregated, and it sounds actually harsher than it was. It was a place set up by Booker T. Washington, and it reflected Washington's philosophy of self-help. He believed that every black in that era, that Jim Crow was going to survive for a long time, and every black had to find out what they did well and do it as well as they could and better than anybody else. Satchel found out during those years that he could pitch a baseball. He had a coach who taught him the classic Satchel Paige pose, which was kicking his leg so high in the air that it looked like it blacked out the sky, and reaching his right arm forward like a catapult to the point where when he released the baseball, his hand looked like it was in the batter's face. And as he said at age 17 when he finally got out of reform school, he said, "I traded 5 years of freedom to learn how to pitch."
You know what it reminded me when I read that part of your book? Of the story of Babe Ruth, who also learned to hit a baseball in a reform school. And there was a priest who taught him how to, his uppercut swing, and he became the first great home run hitter because he had this very unorthodox swing, which was actually taught to him by a priest in a reform school. So I saw the parallel between those stories.
Steve, I love the parallel, and the parallel is there in everything but the fact that Satchel had, in addition to all the things that Babe had to overcome by being in a reform school and having to learn what he could while he was there, Satchel had this whole other dimension of race, which banished him to the Negro Leagues, whereas Babe could go right to Broadway.
And he spent 20 years in the Negro Leagues. And you, big part of the book is recounting his travels. And as you point out, the Negro Leagues were both a symbol of segregation, but yet also reflected black ingenuity and black entrepreneurship. And it was really a duality there.
It was. The same way black schools of that era were, on the one hand, they had unequal facilities and they were a sad reflection of the segregated era. They also produced wonderful teachers and great institutions. The Negro League showed that the best of black baseball were really terrific and equal to the best of white baseball. And they were, on a Sunday afternoon, a Negro League game brought out, they had churches let out early, not just so congregants could make it to that great Sunday pitching duel, but so the ministers could too. And they had all of black society out there. You had ministers sitting next to salesmen, sitting next to janitors and farmhands. You had women saving their best clothes and putting that on for the game, men donning their straw hats and their patent leather shoes. You had for one afternoon a time when blacks could forget all the injustices of the world and they could go out and watch the featured pitching duel of the week, which in every city that he was in always involved the great Satchel Paige.
And one of the things you point out was that while often during the week the Negro Leagues played in ramshackle parks, but on the weekends they would rent out the big major league stadiums and filled them with these crowds, particularly, of course, in the cities with large black population.
They did indeed, and the owners, I thought this was one of the most cynical things that the white owners were doing. One of the reasons that segregation in baseball lasted as long as it did was because owners were making a killing by, when their teams were out of town, renting their ballparks to Negro League teams. But while they rented their ballparks, they often said, "The black players cannot use our locker rooms and our showers." It was okay to have them paying money to play baseball on the field, but not to contaminate the locker rooms.
And the other hypocrisy is that Satchel was very involved in this. In barnstorming tours, black teams would play white teams. You point out that great Bob Feller, Cleveland Indians pitcher, later a teammate of Satchel Paige's, if I'm not mistaken, and Dizzy Dean and other great white figures, that baseball was integrated in this odd way during these barnstorming tours, even while blacks were not allowed into the official major league.
Exactly. They were doing these barnstorming tours. Satchel was doing it with Dizzy and later with Bob Feller. He was playing in the winter in California, in the California Winter League, which had white teams playing against black ones. And the best of all showcase of blacks playing against whites and even on the same teams was in Latin America. Every winter in Puerto Rico and Cuba, in the Dominican Republic and Venezuela, blacks and whites played together after their seasons were over, and it was extraordinary baseball, and it was an extraordinary look at just how well integrated baseball could work a generation before Jackie Robinson was signed.
And it also, you point out in the book, that it proved that black players were the equal of whites and could compete, and that was also critical in reaching that moment when the Dodgers signed Jackie Robinson.
That is absolutely true, and no black player proved it in more ballparks in more parts of America for more fans than Satchel Paige.
And we mentioned Joe DiMaggio. What was the circumstances where he pitched to Joe DiMaggio?
the circumstances were that the Yankees were trying to test out this young talent, and they weren't sure he was ready to come to New York. So Joe DiMaggio was in Northern California. The way they tested him, which was the way that lots of white players in that era were tested, is they brought Satchel Paige up from Southern California with a black barnstorming team, and they had Satchel pitch against Joe. So I want to bring you to the 10th inning of that game. The score is tied 1-1, a runner on third base, and Joe DiMaggio is facing off against Satchel. His first three times up, Joe didn't come close to getting a hit. This time, he lines a liner off of Satchel's glove. Satchel deflects it to second base. The second baseman throws it 1 second too late to first base. The run scores. The Yankee scouts at the game send a telegram to the Bronx saying, Joe's ready for the big times, hit Satchel Paige, one out of four. It was a great story for Joe. The sad thing is that while Joe DiMaggio went off to Broadway, Satchel Paige went back to Outer Mongolia. And Satchel said, I spend more time and get more press for what happens to guys like Joe DiMaggio than for when I'm pitching my best baseball.
And was there, did you ever decide for yourself, one of the legends, the many legends about Satchel, was he once faced Babe Ruth? Did he or not? What do you think?
I think he did, and I have two witnesses who say he did. One was the famous Buck O'Neill, and the other was somebody who...
One of the great stars of the Negro Leagues.
One of the great stars of the Negro Leagues, one of the great storytellers, and the other was none other than Joe's 92-year-old daughter, Julia Stevens, who said that she remembers them facing off. Buck suggests the reason Satchel conveniently forgot that was that Babe hit a home run off of Satchel. But in classic Satchel form, Buck says, after the home run, Satchel stood at home plate waiting for the baseball and got Babe to sign it.
I'm talking to Larry Tye. His book is a biography of the great Satchel Paige. Give us a call. We got some lines open. Join our conversation, and Larry and I will be right back. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane today, and my guest this hour is Larry Tye. He's a prize-winning journalist at the Boston Globe. He was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard. He now runs a Boston-based training program for medical journalists. He's written four books, but his new one is called Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. You can join our conversation with Larry Tye, 1-800-433-8850, or drshow@wamu.org. Now, Larry, one of the core of your book is this whole question of who was going to be the first black to enter the major leagues. Satchel Paige, as the great star of the Negro Leagues for 20 years, always thought it was him, should be him. As you said, he was the one who proved more as much as anybody that blacks could play on a level with whites. And yet when the decision came, it was Jackie Robinson, not Satchel Paige. Why?
That was because I think that Branch Rickey, who was a very conservative, teetotaling guy, looked at Satchel Paige.
Branch Rickey, the
owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers, yeah. Exactly. And Branch Rickey looked at Satchel and said, the guy in 1945 is 39 years old. He's not having his best season. He is potentially washed up, but he's also the kind of guy that I'm never going to be able to control. If I tell him to generally play along, to be quiet, to spend 2 years in the Montreal system in the minor leagues before he comes up the way Jackie Robinson did, Satchel will never do this. So it was an easy choice for him to pick the college-educated, smart, lots of potential in youth, Jackie Robinson. And Satchel initially went along with that. He offered the perfect politically correct response. He said he picked the right guy. You couldn't have done better than Jackie Robinson. He had to have been choking when he said that because he didn't believe that. As he said later, I'm the one who shone a spotlight on the Negro Leagues. I'm the reason that Branch Rickey knew about the all-black Kansas City Monarchs, and I'm the reason he knew about the guy who started out that season as a second-string second baseman, Jackie Robinson.
But if you look at the history of Jackie Robinson and the abuse he had to endure and his remarkable calmness and courage in his early years, you have to say that Rickey was probably right in terms of paving the way for more and more blacks to come into the league.
It's true. I think that he made a great choice in Jackie Robinson. I think we saw the next season that Satchel Paige also would have been a great choice. Two very different kinds of guys. Satchel would have been much more at ease with all the abuse that Jackie had to take, and Satchel, history suggests, may have deserved it, but he couldn't have gone wrong with either of them, is the bottom line.
Now, as you point out, a year after Robinson came to the major leagues in 47, Satchel Paige did get his breaks at Cleveland Indians in a pennant race, needed a pitcher. What happened?
What happened was it was the tightest pennant race potentially in the history of baseball between the Yankees, the Red Sox, and the Indians. And the Indians' unconventional owner, Bill Veeck, had an unusual idea of how to give the Indians the edge in that pennant race. And that idea was to bring in 42-year-old Satchel Paige. He brought Satchel in for a tryout one morning along with the player manager for the Indians, Lou Boudreau. And he said, Lou, this is our solution. Boudreau thought he was joking. He looks over and sees this aging Satchel Paige. So Boudreau, who was competing that season for the batting crown with Ted Williams, stands in against Satchel. He takes 30 pitches, and none of them were close to a hit. He says very simply at the end of the tryout, sign him, Will. So the next day, on his 42nd birthday, Veeck signed Satchel. Satchel, as always, came through. Satchel went on to a 6-1 record, the second lowest earned run average in the American League that season. And my favorite is that he got 12 votes at the end of that season for Rookie of the Year. Satchel was delighted, but he said, I'm not quite sure what year they're talking about.
And he did, the Indians went on to win the World Series that year, did they not?
They did win. They won the pennant thanks to Satchel, and they won the World Series. He had just a brief appearance, but this was this guy's dream. He not only made it to the majors, he helped carry his team to the pennant and helped them a little bit in the World Series.
Now, as you say, he by the time he got to the major leagues, he was at the tail end of his career. He spent then a couple more years with the St. Louis Browns, and I started rooting for baseball in 1949. I don't remember him in the 48 Indians, but I do remember him coming to New York, pitching for the Browns against my Yankees when I was a kid, and he still was good. He wasn't the great Satchel Paige, but he was still good.
He was good. It was, again, Bill Veeck who rescued him. Bill Veeck had sold the Indians. Satchel was let go after that. In 51, he was brought back when Veeck came to the Browns, and he pitched really good baseball for a guy in his mid to late 40s.
And do you think, Larry Tye, that there was, in those early years with Jackie Robinson, Satchel Paige, then Larry Doby for the Indians, Monty Irvin for the Giants, the first pioneers, black players. Was it hard on them? Was there a different strike zone for Satchel Paige than for white pitchers?
It was hard on them in terms of not just strike zones. I talked to players who said they were actually offered financial bonuses if they hit one of the black players, or if they took him out in a slide. It was extraordinary what they had to deal with in terms of fan abuse and what they had to deal with in terms of teammate or opposing player abuse. On the other hand, while Doby and Jackie were from the same young generation, and it was really tough on them, and it took a toll on their gut and their whole attitude toward life, Satchel was used to this. He relished the whole experience of being in the majors. Racism was nothing new to him. He was finally making it into the bigs. He was drawing crowds to the point where in Kaminsky Park, they broke down a turnstile in setting a record in coming to see Satchel Paige. They did that in Cleveland's Municipal Stadium all across the league. People had heard about Satchel Paige for years, but like you when you were growing up, actually seeing the great Satchel Paige was something everybody wanted to do.
And he actually pitched his last game in 1965, right?
It was an extraordinary game. It was, again, a character of an owner named Charlie Finley, who owned the Kansas City A's, wasn't filling up his ballpark. So he decided for one game in September he was going to bring Satchel back. He situates him in the bullpen in a rocking chair. A nurse with a white uniform is there attending to him. He has a personal ball boy. Fans came to see it, and Finley didn't care what happened when he inserted Satchel into the game. Satchel, as I've said before, never disappointed his owners. He came in for three innings. He pitched three innings of shutout baseball. The only guy to get a hit off him was Carl Yastrzemski, who after the game — Yastrzemski's not known as an effusive guy — after the game, he gave Satchel a huge bear hug. And he did that partly because Satchel pitched a great game, more because a generation before, Yastrzemski's dad had hit against Satchel on Long Island. Satchel was the only guy who played long enough for fathers and sons and even grandsons all to bat against him. That day in Kansas City, he set a record that we can think of when we think of what Tom Watson almost did yesterday. Satchel, like Watson, was 59 years, 2 months, and 8 days. It was a record for the major leagues in terms of age of a ball player that will never be broken, and he was exactly 30 years older than his catcher that night.
And, of course, one of the reasons why we remember Satchel Paige is that he was the author of so many aphorisms that rival Yogi Berra as a bard. And, of course, the most famous is some version of "never look back because something might be gaining on you." What's the history of that? Did he really say it? And why has it resonated all these years as an idea?
He said extraordinary things. He was extraordinarily eloquent. He had his five rules for healthy living, one of which, the most famous, was "don't look back, somebody might be gaining on you." The fact is that a writer for Collier's Magazine, on a deadline, was told by an editor, "come up with a sidebar of Satchel's sayings." He took some that Satchel said, he took some that Satchel might have said or should have said, and we're not sure which is which. Everybody admitted that there were some inventions, but to me, it's like all of Satchel's legends. 80% of the ones that I could determine were true, 20% were ones that he embellished. Which raises the obvious question of why embellish if 80% of all of these extraordinary things are actually fact. And I think he did it because while the great white heroes like Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio, and Mickey Mantle had reporters there fanning every legend of theirs, everything they said, mm-hmm. Satchel spent his prime in the Negro Leagues, where there were no reporters covering most of his games, and he had to fan his own legend, and he was such a good storyteller that he couldn't but help exaggerating at times.
And final question, then we'll get to callers because a lot of people want to join this conversation. His election to the Hall of Fame also brought up the whole question of race, and it's threaded through our whole discussion of this parallel universe of the Negro Leagues. And at one time, when organized baseball finally was moved to try to recognize the great stars of the Negro Leagues, there was talk of a separate wing, which, of course, people said, well, this is, you know, back to the worst separate but equal notions of Jim Crow. What happened with Satchel Paige and the other black ball players from the Negro Leagues in the Hall of Fame?
As you say, the original proposal was to put Satchel in a separate court of the hall. Fans and journalists expressed such outrage at the idea of segregating the Hall of Fame after they were trying to make up for their years of segregation that Satchel was admitted in 1971 to the center of the hall, the same with everybody as everybody else. And today, the beautiful thing is, if you go to this coming weekend's induction ceremonies, the only two living players being inducted are both African Americans, and there is a statue of Satchel Paige outside the hall, and there are dozens of old Negro Leaguers who follow Satchel Paige into being inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Let me read you an email from Joe in Hillsdale, New Jersey. He says, several years before Jackie Robinson signed with Brooklyn, there were attempts to sign Josh Gibson, the only ball player to have hit a fair ball out of Yankee Stadium with a major league team, probably the Pittsburgh Pirates. These efforts were stopped by the racist commissioner of baseball, Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis. Before Robinson signing, were there ever efforts to sign Satchel Paige with a major league team?
Bill Veeck talked about signing Satchel Paige a number of years before Ricky signed Robinson, and the commissioner stepped in and stopped it. Jackie Robinson, I hate to say anything negative about the Red Sox on your show, but the Jackie Robinson was actually given a tryout by the Boston Red Sox, not because Tom Yawkey, the owner, wanted to, but because a Jewish city councilor in Boston said, either you do this or we'll take away your Sunday beer license. They brought in Jackie Robinson. He did a great tryout. Nobody ever intended to sign him in Boston, and they didn't.
You and I both have to admit that our two favorite teams were among the last to admit African-American players. Boston finally got Pumpsy Green, and the Yankees finally got Elston Howard. But they were both teams that were very much behind the curve on this. One more quote from Liz Wild writes to us from Fairport, New York, and she says, my dad always used to quote Satchel Paige, the social ramble ain't restful.
That's right. That was one of his five rules for healthy living.
What were the others?
The others had to do with don't angry up your stomach, pacify it with cool thoughts. He talked about all kinds of things in his rules for healthy living, which sounded brilliant and were things that he never did himself. He angered up his stomach with the hottest foods he could. He did the social ramble everywhere he could. And the one thing that he really stuck to was not looking back.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's turn to some callers, Larry. And Anne in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning, Steve. It's good to hear your voice.
Thanks for being with us.
I just was thrilled throughout my life that at some point when I was a kid, I was a member of the Keyhole Gang for the Browns in St. Louis, and I got to see Satchel sitting in his wheelchair and then amble out to the pitching mound and pitch maybe three pitches and then go amble back to his rocking chair. And it's still just one of the highlights of my life. And I tell this story to everyone when his name comes up because I just was thrilled to think that I was there to see this man pitch. So that's all I had to say.
Well, thank you so much, Larry.
Okay, have a great day.
Thank you, Ann.
All I have to say is that I'm jealous and I wish I could have been there. And Satchel did amble out to the mound. He basically soaked the crowd for every applause that he could get because, as he said, they can't start the game till I get there.
Is there any extant film of him pitching?
There is limited film, and we actually tried to analyze the film to see if we could figure out how fast he was pitching. And the film that we found when he was in his 50s pitching suggested he was still doing it in the high 80s.
And, of course, the top major league pitchers pitch now at 96, 97, with an occasional hitting 100. In his prime, of course, he didn't have radar guns. Do you think he hit 100?
Well, I would trust what Bob Feller said. And Bob Feller, who was a wonderful pitcher, but very seldom had nice words to say about anybody but Bob Feller. Bob Feller says not only was Satchel the greatest, but Satchel pitched between 100 and 105 miles an hour in his prime.
And Feller himself approached 100, so he didn't know what he was talking about.
He did indeed. He did.
Let's talk to Don in Salt Lake City. Don, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you for taking the call. I was also grew up in St. Louis, and I believe I saw Satchel Paige pitch the last time for the St. Louis Browns in Sportsman's Park, and I was wondering if your guest could give me a year on that, because as a kid, I didn't realize the significance at the time.
It would have been 53, and I think the significance is impossible to convey because it was brilliant, and I wish that I had been there, and I hope you really were there.
I was.
Great. That's terrific.
Okay, Don, thanks. One of the rewards of rooting for the St. Louis Browns, you didn't have a lot to root for, but such a pick.
That's for sure.
Okay, thanks for your call. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
Joseph in Clinton Township, Michigan, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Well, thanks, Steve. Great subject. I have a brief recollection of Satchel Paige, too, and I heard the date mentioned, 1965. I believe I was in the old Tiger State Brick Stadium, and I believe the KC Royals were playing at the time, and they got Satchel Paige out on the mound in his wheelchair, rocking chair. And I didn't realize the significance at the time either because I was just 14 years old. Can you tell me if that's true? Because I heard he was brought up by Charlie Finney in round 65 there. Did he make a tour? Did he do some of the stadiums? Thanks a lot.
After he pitched, he only pitched one game in 65, and that was the three innings in Kansas City against the Red Sox. What he said after that game, after he pitched the three shutout innings, was, now they know how good I am. I'm ready. Here's my phone number. And unfortunately, no other major league teams called.
Well, you know, as our caller indicated, legend, people think they were at places. I was listening to a broadcast the other day, and a commentator was talking to David Cone, the great Yankee pitcher, about his perfect game with 10-year anniversary this week. And the commentator said, of course, there were 400,000 people in the stands the day you did it. So maybe they saw Satchel, maybe they didn't. But he had that kind of power that people wanted to be there.
They did. And what we can say definitively is that Satchel, over his years, pitched more baseballs for more fans in more ballparks for more teams than any player in history. So most people's memories are probably right on this.
As you point out, that he had about 2,500 games, but which is twice the record. We'll get back to that with Larry Tye. His book is called Satchel. Give us a call, and you'll be part of our conversation. 1-800-433-8850, drshow, WAMU.org. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane. I'll be back with Larry Tye in just a minute.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From Kaufman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kaufman.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Join us each weekday on Fresh Air for conversations with writers, actors, and musicians, as well as interviews about stories in the news. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts. I'm sitting in today for Diane, and our subject this hour is baseball, and particularly Satchel Paige, the great pitcher who spent many years in the Negro Leagues and finally, in 1948, made it to the major leagues, one of the first blacks to integrate Major League Baseball. Larry Tye is with me, a former reporter at the Boston Globe, who now has written a book called Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. And Larry, we were just talking before the break about how many games Satchel Paige actually pitched in his long career. And you said he really probably pitched more, almost certainly pitched more than any pitcher in history. You estimate, and of course it's hard to be precise, maybe he pitched 2,500 games. The man who's pitched the most major league games in history, Jesse Orosco, pitched, I think, 1,250 roughly.
Exactly.
So that gives our listeners a sense of the magnitude of what he did.
It does, and I'd love to look at that number because I think the number of games he pitches is a great metaphor for all of his claims. He said he pitched 2,500. Orozco holds a major league record with half of that, and yet when you look at the two of them and you say that Orozco pitched, even as a reliever, he pitched every couple nights. Satchel pitched three or four innings just about every night. Orozco, if he was lucky, pitched from April into the playoffs in October. Satchel pitched from April to April all around the hemisphere. And Orozco pitched for 24 years. Satchel Paige pitched for more than 40. So when you start looking at those comparisons, you say maybe 2,500 was an understatement.
But one of the questions I'm sure people have is, what was the secret of his durability, given the fact that modern pitchers, you have modern medicine, you have modern training events, and yet they seem to be more fragile than someone like Satchel Paige. What was the secret?
Two secrets. One was great genes that he started with, and the other was, as he said, conditioning, that the way you keep an arm in shape is by keeping it in shape. And he would look at today's pitchers who have pitch counts and who pitch every fifth game and say they're being babied. He had what we know was the best condition arm on the planet, and it worked for him for nearly 50 years.
Larry Tye, we have some emails here. John writes to us, John Wolfe. I have only one question about Satchel Paige. How tall was he? Was he a big man, a small, wiry one? What kind of frame, body type?
Big and wiry, 6'3", 140 or so pounds. They said that he was so thin that he would have to wear three pairs of socks just to give any substance to his legs. He had incredibly long arms and long legs, and it all worked. I don't know the physics of it, but it all worked brilliantly to catapult the baseball at 100 miles an hour just where he wanted it.
John has a side question. He says that in Ken Burns' wonderful series, television series about baseball, he mentions a fellow named Moses Walker as the first black man to be hired by a Major League Baseball team, the Toledo Blue Stockings, sometime in the 1800s. Roughly 70 years before Jackie Robinson. Sadly, Mr. Walker never was allowed to play in a public game. Do you know about Moses Walker?
Yes, Moses Fleetwood Walker. It's a great point. Jackie Robinson reintegrated baseball. He didn't integrate it. For about 40 years after the Civil War, when we were going through this era called Reconstruction, we were also having racial reconciliation on the baseball field. Blacks were playing professional baseball. Moses Walker was one of the first. They now think there may have been this guy named White who played an inning or two in Providence, Rhode Island before Walker. But the point was, there were blacks who were playing on the same field as whites. They were playing brilliantly, and it looked like it was going to work. And then in the early 1900s, the color barrier came in and lasted until Jackie in 47.
We have another email asking, did Satchel Paige ever meet Moses Fleetwood Walker?
You know? He didn't. Satchel met a lot of guys, and he played a lot of games, but never Walker.
And here's Richard writes from your neck of the woods. As a young man growing up in Rhode Island in the 40s and 50s, I was a diehard Boston Red Sox fan. I was always told that it was Ted Williams who did not want any Negro players on the team. Later, I learned it was owner Tom Yawkey and the Yawkey family who did not want Negroes on the team. Can you provide any enlightenment to this? Does it not seem strange that, that in Boston there would be such a racist owner? How did Sam Jethro, the first Negro of the Boston Braves, of course, later became the Milwaukee and now the Atlanta Braves, come into the major league?
The fact is, it was Yawkey, and that Ted Williams not only didn't do anything to keep Satchel off his team, Ted Williams took time out from his induction ceremony to the Hall of Fame to say that it was essential that guys like Satchel Paige, who had played the best of their years in the Negro Leagues, be admitted. And he was the biggest spur to baseball changing its policy and letting in old Negro Leaguers.
And Dan in Tulsa, Oklahoma writes, I'm a 45-year-old black male, and I remember seeing a TV movie, can't remember the name, about Satchel Paige back in the 70s, I think. After that movie, Satchel Paige was one of my favorite black athletes, second only to Wilma Rudolph, the great track star, and closely followed by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Mr. Paige was a tremendous figure in early baseball, and I only wish I had been born early enough to have seen him play. What was the name of that movie? I'd love to find it for my kids.
The Satchel was actually in several movies. One of them was about the Cleveland Indians called The Cleveland Story. He was in a Western. He was in several other movies, and he actually tried for a career in film. In his later life, he didn't have his kids until he was in his 40s, and he had seven of them to feed. He tried being a movie star. He tried being a deputy sheriff in Kansas City. He tried and failed running for the legislature. So he went back into his 50s and his 60s at doing the only thing he knew how to do, pitching a baseball, and made a living at it.
Now, we have a email from another caller, and this is relates to a comment you made to me off the air. Can you please let listeners know if the Satchel Paige book is appropriate for 14 to 16-year-olds? And you were telling me that there you hope that younger people will read this book.
Yes, it is not only, I think, appropriate for them, it was written for them. This is a book about Jim Crow America disguised as a book about the most sensational pitcher, I think, in the history of the game. And I think that getting kids to sit down and read a story about Jim Crow is a tough sell. Hopefully it's easier getting them to sit down and read a book about the great Satchel Paige.
Nona is on the line from Cincinnati, Ohio, great baseball town. Nona, welcome.
Oh, yes, it is. How about those Cincinnati Reds, huh? But I had a chance to see Satchel in Old Crosley Field in Cincinnati. And around that time, some of the other players were around there. I remember seeing Vada Pinson there. But one of the things I remember the most was reading about Louis Armstrong. And Louis was called Louis Satchel Armstrong because he admired Satchel Paige so much and his craft so much that his nickname was Satchel from Satchel Paige.
God, I hadn't heard that, Larry.
That's a wonderful story. I actually think there are lots of other stories on how Armstrong got his nickname, and I've never heard the Satchel Paige one, and I love it. The fact is that people admired Satchel Paige so much that Woody Allen named his son Satchel, Spike Lee named his daughter Satchel, and a great basketball player in Boston named Tom Sanders called himself Satchel because he so admired Satchel Paige.
Well, I'll tell you what, I can't wait to get the book for my two grandchildren that are 15 and 16. And again, the title again, please. I'll continue to listen and grab as much information as I can, but congratulations.
It's just called it's called Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. If you go to our website, WAMU.org, you can see a picture of the book and get more information.
Oh, that's wonderful. And it was great watching the Reds play the Cardinals, I tell you that.
Okay. keep rooting for your hometown team. Tom Satch Sanders, of course, a great player for the Boston Celtics, and then coach at Harvard for a while, wasn't he? The
basketball? He was indeed, and a great coach at Harvard.
Let's talk to Dave in Chicago. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Dave.
Thanks for taking my call. Talking to a few people, as far as when the African Americans were allowed to enter the majors, you know, they sort of entered in a trickle, not too many one time. And I was told that it wasn't just race that kept the African Americans out of baseball. Because remember, these white players and the black players, as you mentioned, did a lot of barnstorming together. And a lot of the white major leaguers knew, if on a fair basis, if you let African Americans into Major League Baseball, one-third to one-half of the white players would lose their jobs because they weren't as good. And just sort of like blacks against whites in a lot of industries with unions and stuff, a lot of the reasons blacks were kept out of baseball is a lot of the white players at that time didn't want to compete on a fair basis.
Interesting point, Dave. Larry?
I think it's true that they definitely knew that there would be competition and that some of the ones who were at the bottom of the roster might lose their jobs, and that was one more reason. There were lots of reasons. One we talked about before that was critical was that white owners loved continuing to make money renting their stadiums to Negro leaguers, and it was only when they realized they could make more money by bringing in black fans and bringing in great black ball players who white fans love that they started acknowledging that maybe they ought to break down this color barrier.
One of the interesting things that's happened to Major League Baseball recently is the decline of African Americans. At one time, of course, and there still are great stars, but I saw a figure recently, only 8% of major leaguers are native-born American blacks. There are Caribbean players who are, of course, dark-skinned. But are young blacks playing baseball, or do they see the Satchel Paiges and the Larry Dobies and the Willie Mayses as heroes?
Major leagues are trying to figure that out. 30 years ago, 30% of the ball players in baseball were African American. 15 years ago, it was 20%. Today, it's under 10%, and everybody's trying to figure that out. Every team in the majors has a program, a community program, trying to develop interest among African American kids in baseball, but so far, it's not working.
Let's turn to Carl in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Carl. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. I'd like to have your help in identifying what year I saw Satchel pitch. I was living in Miami, Florida, and it was the 50s, and they took the Orange Bowl, which is a football stadium, and converted it to a baseball stadium just for a doubleheader. At that time, the second game of the doubleheader in the AAA was only a seven-inning game, and Satchel pitched the seven-inning game.
It's a great story, and it was in the late 50s when Bill Veeck, who had brought Satchel first to Cleveland, then to St. Louis, was involved with the Miami Marlins minor league team. He brought in Satchel. Again, his management of the team was skeptical. Satchel showed just how good he was, and you're lucky to have seen him there.
He was incredible, boy. That big old curveball he had must have broke 6 feet.
Thanks, Carl. What is it about Satchel Paige that triggers the kinds of memories our callers are calling in? Because you can feel their emotions and their affection radiating through the phone line here.
Your last caller reminded me of what Joe DiMaggio said about Satchel's curveball, which was that it gave him optical indigestion. This guy was partly a brilliant pitcher, and that's what they're talking about, but more importantly, he was the combination of showman and pitcher. He understood in his 20 years in the Negro Leagues to draw crowds and to make the money that he wanted to and did make, that he had to do more than just great pitching. So he would go out to the ballpark before the game. He would set up a matchbook on home plate, walk out to the pitcher's mound, and 10 out of 10 pitches thrown in the high 90s would go directly over the matchbook. And that did two things. It told fans that they were in for an extraordinary show, and it told opponents that they better second-guess what they were about to do, which is just what Satchel wanted them to be doing.
And, of course, another one of the bits of showmanship that you write a lot about, which became very well known, was his ploy of telling his outfielders to sit down or play cards or light a cigarette while he mowed down
It was extraordinary what he did. He would do it not just against junk opponents, but he would do it against major leaguers he was playing against with a score tied or him ahead by one run in the ninth inning. He'd call in his outfielders. They'd sit in the infield talking or playing cards while he was basically daring the batter, saying, if you hit the ball out of the infield, guaranteed home run. He'd strike him out, and he was so confident that at times it was infielders as well as outfielders that he had sit down, and it was just he and the catcher out there.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's turn to Tracy in Annapolis, Maryland. Tracy, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. Actually, your last description lends credence to the question I was going to ask you. My father grew up in the Washington, D.C. area in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and he told me at the time that he saw Satchel Paige put a 6-foot, 1x12 plank at home plate, which with some 16-penny nails tapped into it, and he hammered them in from the pitcher's mound.
I call that my 10-penny plank story, and it showed two things. One, it showed the accuracy that he had, and the other, it showed the power of his pitch to be able to hammer those nails in, and it is true.
I just want to, because my dad used to tell that story all the time, and you know, fathers, when they start telling you the same thing over and over, you tend not to believe them.
Yeah, I can relate to that one. But thanks for your,
thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, Tracy. Thanks for your call. We got time for a couple more. Pete in Rochester, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning. Age was always a question that followed Satchel Paige. Years ago, I heard a quote that was attributed to him when he was asked once how old he was. His response was, "How old would you be if you didn't know how old you was?" And I was wondering if that was true and if you've had any offers on making this a movie.
Thank you, Pete.
From your lips to movie makers' ears, the question of age should have been a simple one. And as a longtime journalist, I got all the government records I could. I got his Social Security record, his draft file, and his passport file, three different dates. They had two things in common. One is they were all supplied by Satchel, and the other is they were lies. The truth was lying there in the Mobile County Health Department in his birth certificate, which showed he was born on July 7th, 1906. And I think that Satchel played with his age, again, because he wanted to create a mystery around himself. So when it was cool to be young, he was as young as Peter Pan. When being old was a thing, he was as old as Methuselah.
And whatever, as you say, it came back to being a showman. Whatever worked to generate interest, to generate crowds, he had a real gift for this kind of mysterious aura, creating an aura around him.
He did indeed, but he also stopped just short of doing anything that would be demeaning. He mm-hmm. understood a show was important, but he was not about to sacrifice his pride.
Let me ask you a final question, a larger question about baseball. What has come through in so many of these calls is tales that parents tell children about things they've seen. You can feel the hometown loyalties of Nona from Cincinnati, or the two people who grew up in St. Louis and saw in the Browns. It's common to say today, well, football is the American sport, pro football, and basketball has exceeded it. But there's something about baseball that comes through in these callers. And what is it, in your view, having written about baseball for so long, that's enduring, that we're hearing?
It is slow. It is eloquent. It's a game where numbers create wonderful mysteries and debates. And it's all captured in Satchel Paige's life better than anywhere that I've seen it.
And I've also... I've come to believe that it's the very everydayness. You talked about 200, you know, 2,500 games. No football player plays 2,500 games or plays 162 games in a season. You know, you pick up the sports pages every morning to read about the Red Sox. I pick them up to read about the Yankees. My grandsons pick them up to read about the Nationals. Mm-hmm. That's part of what baseball does. It's very everydayness.
It's huge. The everydayness is huge. And again, the idea that Satchel was pitching every day let you watch him and have that extraordinary experience on a daily basis.
Larry Tye, his new book is Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. Larry, thanks so much for being with us this morning. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm, and thanks for spending your morning with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner.